Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this evening's programme talk of the Staple Inn Actuarial Society. My name is Emma Hutchinson, and I am the programme convener for SIAS. Before I introduce tonight's talk, I have a couple of notices about upcoming SIAS events. Our next programme talk will be a discussion on Part 7 transfers of business, given by a panel of four independent experts from both life and non-life disciplines. This talk will take place on Tuesday, the 3rd of July, and further details and online registration are available on SIAS's website. Our next social event is a chocolate tasting event on Thursday, the 21st of June, and also the annual SIAS boat party will take place on Friday, the 27th of July. And further information and tickets for both of these events are available on our website. So next, a few standard notices about tonight's event. Tonight's event is hosted by SIAS. We do encourage those of you that aren't currently SIAS members to sign up. Membership is really good value, £23 for IFOA fellows and £12 for IFOA students, and further details are provided on our website. There is an attendance sheet in the smaller room just outside the hall. If you didn't sign this on the way in, please don't forget to sign it on the way out. Attendance at these talks does not get added automatically to your CPD record, so please remember to update your CPD in the normal way after tonight. We're eager for our talks to run as smoothly and effectively as possible and would be delighted to hear any feedback you have. We will email you a short online survey after the talk. Please take a minute or two to complete this. We need your feedback to create the best possible experience for our members. If the fire alarm sounds during the meeting, please exit using the fire exits at the back of the hall. Finally, just a reminder to switch your mobiles to silent. Tonight's talk will last around 1 hour and will be followed by a Q&A with the speakers. If you have a question, please raise your hand and a microphone will be brought to you. We value everyone's contribution at our talks, so there is a bottle of champagne on offer for the best contribution to the discussion by a student member of the IFOA, and another for the best contribution from any fellow of the IFOA. Please clearly state your name and which of these categories you fall into before you ask your questions. Following the meeting, there will be sandwiches and networking drinks in the smaller room just outside the hall. Please do join us for this. Back to tonight's talk. Matthew Edward is a director at Willis Towers Watson, where he leads demographic risk and analytic work in the life practice. He was the lead author of the 2012 SIAS paper, The Philosophy of Modelling, which partly inspired today's session. He is active elsewhere in the profession, including as deputy chair of the CMI and chair of the IFOA Antibiotic Resistance Working Party. Rachel McNaughton studied actuarial studies and computer science at the Australian National University, where she also taught parts of their statistical machine learning course in 2014. Since then, she has been working as a data scientist for Willis Towers Watson, focusing on new and sensible applications of machine learning techniques across life, health, and P&C insurance. So now I'll hand you over to Matthew and Rachel.
Thanks very much, Emma. Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for coming, and hopefully it'll be a very interesting event. The reason I asked Emma to make the reference to the philosophy of modelling paper was that what we're trying to do here is go through a similar thought process with the philosophy of modelling paper, which did with Zaid Hussain, who's not here tonight, I don't think. We were basically sort of saying, there's all this modelling going on, let's take a step back, let's think through what's actually happening, what assumptions are people making without realising they're making them, what are the risks, what can go wrong, how can you improve what you're doing. And we're very much trying to do the same sort of thing here with big data, with advanced analytics. There's lots of work going on, people are doing lots of things, making lots of assumptions, often implicit, and we're trying to sort of think through what's actually going on here, what can go wrong, how can we improve what we're doing. So there's a similar sort of thrust. So to that extent, this is not sort of a thing of two halves, with the first half being me, the second half being Rachel. It's much more a thing of three-thirds, me, Rachel, and then the third is yourselves with the Q&A and the discussion. So as with the previous philosophy of modelling thing, that generated a very good amount of discussion and Q&A. Hopefully we can get the same thing going this time. So I would encourage you to sort of, even without the bribe of champagne, which apparently I'm not eligible for, which is a great shame, to sort of really actively participate in that. With big data and advanced analytics and so on, one of the themes is unstructured data, and we've tried to sort of replicate that theme with the structure of this presentation, as you might call it, an unstructured presentation. So what we've done is going through is trying to sort of think through what are the sort of themes of interest to us, and let's sort of talk about those. So there is a bit of a sort of direction of travel in the whole thing, but it's not going to be a formal agenda with lots of bullet points. So sort of hang on for the ride, in case you're wondering where the overall structure is. So in place of an agenda, we've actually got this disclaimer, so just to note on SIAS's behalf that we're not talking on behalf of SIAS. And also, although we've used a sort of WTW template for convenience, because that's our sort of shop, it's not actually a WTW set of views, just in case anyone's about to sue us or sue anyone else or whatever. So that's the sort of legal disclaimer. So the best analytic journey. Now, this is just in case you're starting with a bit of a misconception. If your idea of the best possible analytic journey is this idea of data, then method, then results. And if your idea of data is all that chocolate, and your idea of the method is some sort of chocolate tasting chart, then unfortunately you're in the wrong place, because as Emma was saying, the result for that is actually happening on the 21st of June. So if at this point there's a mass stampede, then we quite understand you've come to the wrong event. On the other hand, instead of the chocolate, we can at least offer you lots of wine afterwards if you hang around for that. So that's the compulsory joke slide over. might have the odd joke slide further on. So the four Vs, if you've been to any big data analytics type event, you'll know people going on about the four Vs. So we've got the four Vs here with a slightly different slant. So volume, in the sense that there's a huge volume of stuff we could be talking about, but as we said before, we're just going to talk about the things which seem to us to be pertinent issues. We're not trying to be a comprehensive set of thoughts about the whole subject. Variety, we've tried to have a very heterogeneous variety of speakers. So me and Rachel are heterogeneous in respect of background, gender, age. There's a couple of years difference there. And something else as well, actually. Lots of things, actually. And there's probably some unusual aspects of homogeneity, such as running ultras and drinking hot chocolate, but not at the same time. Velocity, as you probably realise, I speak far too fast, but hopefully Rachel will speak more sensible pace. And veracity, this is the sort of point at which I'd say that everything we tell you is true, but as we were sort of saying before, it's really much more of an exploration of some of the issues, and hopefully that exploration will lead to a lot of interesting Q&A and thoughts from yourself. So it's not supposed to be a didactic, what we tell you is true sort of talk, although clearly what we tell you obviously is true. That's sort of definitely the last joke slide. So I want to start by thinking about the direction of travelling we take when we're doing normal modelling. So if you like the modelling everyone was doing up until a few years ago, and people got excited about models with funny names. And there's this very sort of clear direction from cause to effect. The model is trying to work out what that relationship was and to quantify it. And there's a nice quote from William Briggs, whose sort of thoughts we've sort of used for some of these slides. Understanding cause is the fundamental goal of science, and that does nicely sum it all up. So we've got models constructed around some traditional concept of causality. In fact, a lot of the pages in the philosophy of modelling papers are actually all about this whole concept of causality in the first place. So for instance, you might have mortality as a function of age and gender, and obviously you might have slightly more complex models, but they again still sort of enshrine that basic philosophy of causality. And the underlying characteristic of that type of model is that there is some underlying theory, and you sort of occasionally in the literature see these models regarded or described as theoretical models, which is slightly unfortunate terminology. The theory itself could actually be quite loose. I mean, quite an interesting aspect of mortality is that age is very simply, although it's a very, very predictive aspect of mortality models, it's still just a proxy for some unknown biological combination of stuff going on. And not many people actually ever think of it as just a proxy, but it's just a proxy, albeit a very predictive one, but that's still working from our point of view as a cause in that sort of simple causal relationship, also called a generative model. So that's the starting point we've all been growing up with. And this is going through a slight tangent here and thinking through the sort of ways we can improve what's happening with that type of thought process, how we can improve what we're doing when you think about causality. And what I've put down here is what's called the Bradford Hill criteria for causality. And this was Bradford Hill, probably should be calling him Sir Bradford Hill or someone, was a sort of a very renowned doctor in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And these criteria came out in the in the 60s, with particular reference to things like the major epidemiological studies around lung cancer, for instance, Richard Doll's study on lung cancer in doctors. And they sort of go through, I won't sort of go through them all in detail, but they sort of talk you through the sort of things that you should really be thinking about when you're trying to establish whether there is or is not causality, and they're probably quite useful to think about in some of your own work, or maybe also when reading sort of silly newspaper headlines about broccoli relationships with cancer and so on and so forth. So sort of three ones I'm just highlighting here. Is the sort of obviously the massive importance of strength, the effect size. And interestingly, in fact, that sort of particular lung cancer study was talking about effect size of the order of, sort of hazard ratios of size times 10 or times 20, which does sort of put into relationship a lot of the sort of silly studies coming out these days which try to get headlines out of a sort of times plus 20% relationship. Temporality, which obviously sort of feeds nice with this idea of causality, something happens before B, so if A is going to cause B, it needs to happen before B. And plausibility is a very important thing. So in medicine, is there some sort of underlying pathogenesis, for instance, which actually ties in with what you're observing? So just putting that in, just to sort of think through some of the sort of very important things we should be thinking about when we're trying to think about causality in that modelling context. And for those of you who read the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine, which is a great read, you'll realise that this was a reprint of the paper a couple of years ago in honour of the 50th anniversary of the paper. So it has been a very fundamental paper in a lot of epidemiology. Stop plugging. I don't actually have shares in this. You know, I'm just a big fan of it. So things are quite different now in the new age. We've got lots of data, and this is a quotation. You've probably seen bits of these words before from Chris Anderson in a magazine called Wired. I think Chris Anderson, from my research, is also the guy who sort of started the whole thing about TED Talk, so quite an interesting guy. So the point here about Google, which is a good example of lots of data, is that you're not really looking for cause. You're just saying if the numbers point in one direction, then that's good enough. Who knows why people do what they do? The point is that they do it. And with enough data, the numbers speak for themselves. Correlation is enough. We can stop looking for models. So that's really sort of enshrines a lot of the attitudes around big data analytics. You're almost not bothering to think about causality. You're just saying, here are the numbers, here are the results, let's go with that. And as you can imagine, that's fraught with various pitfalls, which we'll be elencating over the next 10 or 15 slides. So what's really happening then with big data? It's almost the reverse of the previous direction of travel. So previously we were going from cause to effect with, if you like, a traditional conception of modelling. And here you could think of it almost the opposite. You've got the effect, and we're trying to sort of think through what are the factors. So in other words, some observed effects, a large number of possible explanatory factors, and we're looking for those which might be material under various plausible structures. And the effects can also be quite broad. It's not necessarily the sort of, you know, the zero or one binary outcome of death or whether or not you buy a policy. It could be sort of some other weird things, for instance, character recognition. But if you think through what we're doing there, because we're not looking, if you like, explicitly properly at causality, it all boils down to a form of seeking associations. And seeking associations, as I'm sure you'll realize, is actually very fraught if you're then trying to use those associations in a predictive way, as we'll come on to. So is this approach going to help us to understand reality? Well, let's think about what we're trying to do when we are trying to understand reality. And it goes, again, back to that conflict, or if like, which is a form of conflict between those two different directions of travel. So we're starting here with this interesting sort of statement about causal laws. I'd rather discover one causal law than gain the kingdom of Persia, by way of a sort of an amusing misprint to avoid. I was doing a presentation yesterday where, luckily in small print, we sort of misspelled causal as casual, which didn't actually come across all that well, but it's definitely causal, not casual. So can big data actually help us discover those causal laws? So some interesting sort of thoughts from a paper, a guy called Rocco Titiunic from the University of Michigan, I think. Big data can enhance and deepen our ability to explore, but the ability to explore doesn't necessarily itself mean we've got some sort of structural breakthrough in that ability to make the causal inferences. And that sort of inundation is a cause of ever-larging amounts of new information is actually giving us more need for critical thinking as opposed to just putting lots of numbers into more different model structures and getting out more results and just believing them all. Another sort of interesting commentator on this, Jennifer Hill, in a paper called Causal Inference and Data Science, thinking through some of the issues there, that data science needs causal inference really to prevent us from just going with associations, going with correlations, rather than trying to understand the real causality. And then concluding on that bottom point, we've sort of talked, therefore, of a contradiction or sort of a contraflow between the sort of traditional modelling from cause to effect and the sort of advanced analytics approaches you might describe as from effect to cause. But there are actually ways to try and join those two camps up to have sort of big data, advanced analytics type exercises in ways that involve causal inference. And probably at the end, I think we're going to have sort of hopefully a bit of a discussion about what those ways might be, and try to see if anyone's interested in engaging in some, potentially some sort of mini working party or something to explore some of those ways. So comparing those two approaches, and I mean, particularly sort of huge number of pages could be written comparing those two approaches, causal models on the left, sort of big data advanced analytics approach on the right. So if you want to go into philosophical terminology, the philosophical terminology might be sort of epistemology, like the study of knowledge on the left, so you're actually trying to understand what the causes are, as opposed to ontology, where you're purely concerned about the underlying phenomenon or the event or the resulting phenomenon, an ontological approach, what it's all about the effects, who really cares about the causes. So the causal model hopefully is helping us with our understanding where there is some causality, as opposed to the big data approach, where it might actually be helping us to find causality where we don't know what's going on because there's so many factors, or because the underlying process doesn't lend itself easily to some sort of clear theory. Causal models, obviously, well, generally fairly simple and transparent, as opposed to the sort of more black box approach. You've got this aspect of hopefully more qualitative rigor with the causal models along the lines of the Bradford Hill criteria we mentioned, as opposed to a somewhat more sort of algorithmic, mathematical, and potentially misleading approach with the advanced analytics. And then this whole idea of counterfactual fairness, do my data actually work in a scenario where it's vaguely, you could think about it vaguely like a null hypothesis, is my model actually working in terms of these sort of data which aren't supposed to be affected by my hypothesis, and this is something which Rachel will hopefully explain better than I've explained. So finishing off there, I won't go into this boring stuff around computational speed and data requirements and so on, but the main concern you've got at the end is this potential confusion of association with causation, which actually may not be a problem from a predictive perspective, as we'll come on to, but it may be quite a big ethical problem, as Rachel will be dealing with later on. So you see now what I meant about velocity of talk, so I'll try not to go too fast. So we talked about possible problems if we're sort of taking association and assuming that association is predictive. Well, here's a very fascinating correlation from this fun spurious correlations website, correlation between sort of letters and the winning word of Scripps National Spelling Bee versus number of people killed by venomous spiders. You can see there's a very clear correlation. It's quite nice when you're looking at these, if the correlations include all the various curves as opposed to just a general trend. So from this, you might reasonably conclude that, you know, if you're rating a life policy, which is paying out more for people killed by venomous spiders, which obviously, you know, could be popular in some places, then if the only data you have is to do with spelling bee word length, then, you know, that could actually be a useful tool. It's not necessarily unpredictive if everything else in the known universe is staying constant. So the aspect of association correlation does not necessarily mean it's not predictive. It clearly is very dangerous, though, because so many other things that could be changing would be affecting what's really going on underneath that. And clearly that's a nonsensical example, as are all the other amusing examples on that website. But if we go down the route of thinking association implies some predictive ability without understanding what the underlying causality is, it seems to be a very slippery slope. That then leads on to this idea of expert judgment, in that how are we going to get away from interesting models based on lots of data which produce lots of numbers? How are we actually going to think through what's going on there? Well, to the extent, in my view anyway, that big data works, it's actually much less concerned about those underlying causes, then it'll be less predictive as things change. A lot of these things work very well if everything else stays put, and we were sort of saying before, that correlation, if everything else in the universe stays put, then that correlation between word length and spiders might actually be useful. But things in general change, hence the need to understand what's going on and, if you like, aim off for that, and hence the need for some form of expert judgment. And the various different areas where expert judgment is important in these things, and I think it's being not given enough due, certainly from some of the things we've seen. So this idea of first 2-point trends over time and extrapolation beyond well-populated data ranges, we'll come on to that in the next slide. There's a whole aspect of reasonableness of results, not just the overall results, but if you like some of the, if like sub-results generated in the modeling. There's this idea of allowing, in terms of the way the results come out, allowing for regulatory conduct restraints, but also allowing for some sort of common sense principle. So if you're using these devices in sort of real-time pricing, and it's happening more and more on the non-life side, non-life insurance, real-time pricing based on 50 or more factors with algorithmic, effectively sort of robotic attitude to setting a price. If you don't have some constraints in what the computer is sending out as prices to the portal, then you could end up with quite ridiculous prices. Quite a nice quotation from O'Neill, who's the author of the Weapons of Math Destruction. So I'm saying that without a lisp, Weapons of Math, not Math Destruction. big data processes codify the past, they do not invent the future. So all you're doing with big data is a very complex way of getting a very interesting something to do with recent or not so recent data. It doesn't necessarily imply anything useful about the future, although it may do. You really need to be aware of that potential discontinuity. So two of the points there, trends over time, and going beyond the data range, and hopefully these are fairly obvious examples. And this, I'll see if this points. Pointing at something. No. Anyway, might have lasered somebody's eye out there. Trends over time. So there's an interesting graph, which I think it's to do with credit defaults on personal loan applications or something like this. I actually took it from a very good presentation David Hand did at the Institute a couple of weeks ago. David Hand is an Imperial College statistician. He did a talk in terms of Actuarial Research Council thing, which is not on the Institute website. So if you're sort of any sort of the left-hand edge of the graph and you think things are going to stay like that, then clearly you'll be wrong because they're going to sort of curve upwards. If you start curving upwards and you think things are going to carry on curving upwards, then you'll be wrong because they actually end up sort of plateauing for a year or so. If you're on that plateau, you think the plateau's stabilised, and clearly you'll still be wrong because in fact things compound back up. And if you're compounding back up on the right and you think things are going to carry on going that way, then clearly you'll still be wrong because obviously it's not going to carry on to infinity. So there's some sort of fairly obvious things you can do about thinking through trends over time, whether it's, you know, customer behaviour or buying patterns or longevity or whatever it might be. And then going beyond the data range is another interesting one, because your mass of data, clearly there'll be lots of data, and if you like, in the sort of the centre of the bell shape in a sort of multidimensional context. So you can see from there that, that whatever that curve might be describing, you'll have some sort of central range where there's lots of data and that shape seems reasonable. But if you were to extrapolate that beyond where you've got the data, which is what that red dotted line is showing, if you were to extrapolate in a sort of in a sort of default option mathematical way, you're clearly going to get, you're likely to get nonsensical results. And again, that's very important for some of these things we're seeing around pricing. If you've got lots of information about the price elasticity of your policyholders in terms of variations of plus minus 2 or 3% of premium, and just extrapolate those to what's going to happen to plus or minus 10%, you'll end up with an algorithm for pricing that's going to produce you ridiculous results. So there's a lot of expert judgment to be applied at any of these sort of to any of these aspects. So moving on to another theme in our sort of slightly unstructured presentation. Another problem then is all around data, the data you're getting in, and whether that's going to actually itself lend to some form of bias. And starting with the bottom line of there, I mean, a sort of traditional formulation of this problem was garbage in, garbage out. And we're sort of looking at now more of a problem of, you know, given that data is often well controlled, it's more of a concern that you might have a sort of bias in, bias out. If your data selection is biased, then clearly your results are likely to have, well, almost certainly going to be equally biased. So recent examples, anything to do with Twitter, really. So the people who actually use Twitter themselves are rather sort of non-standard subset of the population. Then in particular instances, they might be particularly unusual. So there's been a lot of analysis of the Twitter responses to Hurricane Sandy over in America, where there has 20 or so million tweets being sent over that period. But it transpired that a disproportionate number of them were actually from sort of safe flats in Manhattan, and a disproportionately low number from the actual affected areas, simply because a lot of people in the affected areas, their sort of cell phones had run out of battery, so they weren't able to tweet. So there's an enormous form of selection bias there. That sort of bottom right-hand thing map is quite amusing. It's a study on the sort of studying the vocabulary in Twitters or tweets, the vocabulary of whether they were sort of hateful or sort of nice tweets. So you can see California is quite a sort of pleasant place to be tweeting. And we were sort of trying to work out earlier whether you could sort of work out whether there's a big sort of red zone around where Donald Trump resides, which you might associate with sort of rather sort of fervent tweets. But anyway, it's a good example of sort of the range of things you can seek to measure with tweets. But again, there's still a huge amount of self-selection involved into whether that population is relevant to potentially to wider populations or extending that to other sources of big data. Facebook, a lot of the sort of Cambridge Analytica type of applications or news around Facebook, that seems to be the case that they can only reliably use Facebook pages where people have got a sort of a liking habit of having 50 or more likes in their sort of feed or activity or whatever you call it, which is clearly a non-trivial subset, or rather a non-100% subset of all people using Facebook, which is itself a subset of the whole population. So various forms of selection bias there if you're using anything based on things like Twitter or Facebook or indeed smartphones in general. Another interesting example was trying to use motion in sort of weird motion in the GPS signal in people's mobile phones to detect bad road quality and potholes. It then transpired that there's obviously sort of disproportionate bias in terms of smartphones being used in city areas as opposed to out in the sticks. And then various different sources of selection bias we can all feed into that. So we've got sort of natural mechanisms such as survivorship bias. So if you're trying to analyse an overall process, there's a tendency to want to sort of analyse the successes or the survivors and rather than what's actually happened in the sort of failing or death process, this whole aspect of non-response, if you're doing some sort of survey or are you actually being non-representative in terms of only looking at the respondents as opposed to the non-respondents, there's a whole sort of field of things there. And a couple of ones, harking, data dredging, I'll look at on the next slide. But just to note, if you've got bias data coming in, which is very likely in many different respects, you're likely to get biased results coming out if you don't try and allow for that in some way. So those sort of weird words you might have seen before on the previous list, data dredging and harking. You might have come across some of these ideas before. There's a sort of p-value sort of joke cartoon here from this website, XKCD, which is quite good fun if you like weird little cartoons. There's a point being here that if people are particularly obsessed with a rather narrow interpretation of p-values, which are themselves can be quite misleading. You might regard anything less than 5% as a glorious success, but then you start sort of fudging things. If they're a bit more than 5%, you might just want to sort of, you know, tweak your calculations or redo the test or just say they're suggestive as opposed to significant, or if they go beyond 10%, look at subgroups. And there's been a bit of a standing joke, which is probably actually completely true about the pharma companies. If you're a pharma company wanting to sell $100 billion worth of statins, then clearly you've got quite a big interest in fiddling this. So you do sort of 20 slightly different tests or studies, and then one of them would be, by definition, significant at 1 in 20 level, that sort of thing. So various different ways of fiddling that. Now, with the advanced analytics methods we're using, we have anything as sort of simple as p-value, which is probably thankful. On the other hand, it's still the same concept. You could be effectively sort of churning through your studies in order to effectively reach the results you want to reach. And this weird phrase, harking, is relating to that. It sort of stands for H-A-R-K, is hypothesizing after the results are known. In other words, rather than going in terms of that initial direction of travel from cause to effect, setting down your study, seeing what the effect is, does it seem to be relevant to what I was initially hypothesizing? It's almost the opposite, is starting at the back, sort of starting at the end and working backwards along the lines of the sort of second direction of travel, starting with the effect and working backwards, which can be fraught. And sharking and tharking is a fun variant of that. I guess sharking would have lent itself to a nice little logo there. So sharking is secret harking, which in fact it normally is, so secret hypothesizing after the results are known, or tharking is the opposite, piece of transparent harking. So again, it's the same sort of danger or problem of trying to work everything out once you've sort of already known the results, but sort of working things out in a somewhat sort of misleading way. And there's a sort of similar potential for sort of being naughty with data dredging, where you basically just sort of churn your data around in different ways until you get the results you want. So that's the fast part of the talk over. Should we want something more sensible?
Okay, so a lot of what Matthew's gone through might seem a bit like doom and gloom. Why would anyone want to touch big data or machine learning now? You know, causal is the only way to go. Correlations are the end of the world for all of us. So I just want to take a step back and think, well, actually, not necessarily. You know, it's as we start to move, it applies to the causal when we're doing causal models as well as machine learning and more the correlation effect-based approach. But whenever we do anything, there's going to be pitfalls, there's going to be downfalls, but as long as we know what they are and we can think about what they are, there's usually ways to actually overcome those issues and you know, adjust for what happens for when it goes wrong. So it's an important point here to note that all models are wrong, but it's more, the more practical question is how wrong do they have to be useful, which is what George Box said. So, you know, instead of just thinking, okay, we can't go and use all this stuff, it's more important, we think, to actually make sure that we're aware of how it can go wrong and know this up front. You know, and how do we do that? How quickly can we find out? Thinking about using proxies to monitor experience before it will monitor the model performance before the actual experience emerges. Even if it is wrong, does it really matter that much? It's all well and good to use a causal model, but if correlation works just as well, maybe it's fine to go with that. Maybe it's fine to go with the neural network model that can predict whether or not the image is a cat or not. But maybe it's less good to use the neural network model to predict that the life insurance premium for someone. And something else we need to think about too is, you know, a model's going to be wrong, okay? How quickly can we find out? But also more importantly, which will lead into our choices and what we do before we even build the models and do the analytics, is how quickly can we adjust? How big will be the impact if the model is wrong? What will be the risk? What will the effect be of that? And then, you know, how quickly can we adjust? And, you know, actually our choice of models and our choice of how we do the analysis will impact how quickly we can adjust. And that's something that we need to keep in mind to make sure that we're not just going blindly down a path of using whatever it is that happens to be the coolest thing at the time. So on this point, we've already talked about how some things can go wrong. I'm going to continue talking about how these things can go wrong because it's important to know how things can go wrong. So application of results. So, you know, how do we even know if it's wrong in the first place? Any analysis should come after understanding what decisions will be made with the measurements, is what Briggs says. This is one of the key things that we need to make sure we're doing. Understanding our objectives, okay? And this is one of the key areas where things can potentially go wrong, especially as we move from, if we are moving, again, we may not necessarily move away from using causal-type models to, what, you know, the causal-type approach to more of a machine learning approach. But it's quite important to understand what our objectives are, especially because the way we used to do things, a lot of objectives might be very implicit. We don't necessarily understand that we're satisfying those objectives or thinking about those objectives, whereas when we move to a more automated machine learning type world, some of those objectives become a little bit harder to satisfy, a little bit harder to measure. So what are our objectives? Well, there's an obvious one, so maybe we want our models to be quite predictive. But there's issues with that as well. So what do we mean by, well, even just a good model? What do we mean by a good model? Okay, and actually how we define how a model can be good, you know, we can get that wrong. So, for example, think about, you know, a measure of goodness. So what is a measure of goodness? Maybe it's a number. Maybe it's the root mean squared error, maybe it's the Gini coefficient or whatever that might be. So first of all, that is just a single number and that might not be the right number. So it may not actually reflect the performance of your model that you're interested in. And so being careful about what metric we choose and also what metric that, what data that metric is actually calculated on. And I'll go into this a bit more detail later, but even just the idea that calculating your error or your model performance on the data you train it on is not a good idea because that might not be reflective of what you actually want your model to do. And that's partly about what the objective is actually our objective is not how good is our model on the training data. Our objective really is how good is our model going to be in the future. So just thinking about what sorts of ways we use to measure performance is quite important. But also on that point, it's not just necessarily how good our model is, but why do we even care about how good our model is in the first place? We kind of need to think about what decisions will be made on the basis of this model and making sure that when we produce our, you know, goodness of fit measures or statistics, that they're suitable for the subsequent decisions that might be made based on those numbers. And that's something I'll go into a bit more detail later. But first, what are the other objectives? So again, maybe not that far a stretch to think about, but time it takes to actually build a model and do the analytics can affect, I guess, what types of model and what types of analytics you want to do. Also, how quickly does it need to execute? And fundamentally, why we're doing this usually it's to make money. Okay, so actually thinking about those sorts of things, they may not always be consistent with getting the best outcome for the good model is in terms of predictive accuracy. So keeping those things in mind, so when you build a model, you can quite easily say, well, okay, my objective is predictive accuracy, so you've trained your model to be the best predictor it can, and then, you know, we just make some decisions on the side to say, okay, well, these models are out because they take too long to build, they take too long to process when we're trying to get a quote live on a system. But there's actually a lot more that we don't necessarily think about all the time. And these sorts of things are the ones that we tend to take for granted when we think about building GLMs or just doing simple analysis that were, or not necessarily simple, but the causal type analysis that we're used to. One is we're always going to want to be able to communicate our results. We're always going to want to be able to understand to some extent. Sometimes we may not need to understand as much, but there will be times that we do. Another important point is ethics or fairness. It's like we want our models to be fair. Okay, and these are objectives that are fairly straightforward in the causal world to satisfy. Okay, especially think about the fairness idea is that, okay, if we're only going to rate, if we're going to build a model that's causal in nature, then just don't rate on the variables that are protected. So don't rate on race, don't rate on gender. Okay, then we should end up with some sort of fair model. So these are the types of objectives we need to be thinking about. We need to be thinking much more broader than just predictive accuracy. But then how do we actually make sure these objectives are satisfied? One, we can think about the objectives up front and then work out how to optimize the analytics to satisfy those in the first place, which can be easy for some of these, for the predictive accuracy, for the money. Maybe there can be constraints and things that we consider which make sure that it's an interpretable model or it uses interpretable factors. Some things like ethics sometimes can be coded in, sometimes they cannot. So for those things you can't necessarily code in, we need to think about how we actually measure the success to make decisions based on that, about whether the model is suitable or not. So more detail about what exactly I mean with the predictive accuracy point or the goodness of model in particular. So thinking about actually communicating these results or, you know, making decisions off the back of them. And one quite a big thing we need to be careful of is overconfidence in the results. We don't want to be making decisions based on an overconfident, result or feeling. So this is an interesting thing. I'm not sure if you've seen this a lot before, but, you know, presenting your model and showing the actual, okay, the point estimate, which is the model fit, showing that, okay, it fits those lines is all well and good, which basically answers the question, not so much answers the question, but says, my model says if X is this, then Y is that. So, you know, this isn't necessarily a good indication of the uncertainty in our model, is it? It tells us that this is the model, but it doesn't actually tell us what the uncertainty is. And usually we do care a lot about what the uncertainty in our model is, especially when we think about model risk and the impacts of what happens when we put this model into practice. So we look at a confidence interval. X is this, then what the true model says Y is between these two values with 95% probability. So that's not exactly that useful, really. Yes, it tells us, and especially for someone who's building the model, it tells us what the parameter uncertainty is. It tells us, okay, we've estimated this model based on the data, but where does the true model actually lie? Because this isn't necessarily the true model. And that's all well and good, but actually we can go a step further and say, well, really what people care about when they look at these types of models to make decisions based on, and things like prediction intervals. So if X is this, then the probability that the prediction, or the probability that Y is between these two values is 95%. So thinking about what numbers we use to communicate and how they can lead to overconfidence in the model is quite important. So that's just thinking about, you know, goodness of fit, more or less, of a model on a particular set of data. But what sort of data how should we even be testing this? What sort of data should we be calculating our various metrics on? So back in, I guess you think about experimental analysis, not much training data available, so you calculate things like p-values, etc., on all of your data. And I guess there's all sorts of problems with that, but especially in a causal world, maybe that's not so bad all the time, because you're thinking about actually what the causes might be. We might want to move on to something and say, well, actually, you know, our objective isn't to see how well our model does on the data it was trained on. Okay, our objective is to see how well our model does on future data it's going to see. So we do something where we basically have a holdout sample. So we train our model on the training data, and then to actually decide whether or not it's good enough to get our goodness of model, goodness of fit statistics, we calculate those on the validation data set, because that gives us a better idea of how the model will perform on unseen data. But this can also prove problematic, because if we want to actually build our model, we want to make decisions during the model building process. Okay, and how do we make those decisions? We make those decisions based on how well the model is performing. We can't calculate statistics, decide how well the model is performing on the validation data set, then update it, and then test it again on the validation data set, because that's cheating. That's just basically building the model on the validation set. You're seeing something in the future, and decisions about how the model is built is based on things that you shouldn't know. So there's a better way to do this. So we train, we have a test set aside that we can use to update our model to get the best model, and then we do a final validation on the validation set to see, you know, how well our model performs in future. This is better, but we tend to run into issues where we're lacking data now. So here comes the new thing, which is where we see in machine learning and how the machine learning world tends to approach this problem. They use something called cross-validation. So the idea is, instead of just using a single training set, getting a single value on the test set to determine how good that particular model is on that test set, potentially overfitting to that test set as you train that model, and then testing once on the validation set, we can do something quite nice where we take three of these, use those three to train the model, and then for the final one, test the model on that particular one. Okay, and then you repeat, so that each of those folds, we call them, ends up being used as the validation set. So we get an idea of, for different sets of data that the model is trained on, because the model can vary depending on the different data set it's trained on, how well will it do? Is this a much better indication of its generalization error, how well it's going to do on future data points? And usually that's where people tend to stop and they say, okay, that's great, we've overcome the problem of how we used to do things. Not only now does this method tell us, you know, how more robustly how well it's going to do on future validation sets, because you're not getting just one measure of how it's going to do, you're getting four measures of how it's going to do, so you get a bit more of a distribution. You also get a little bit more information about how the variance of the model, how stable it is. But it still could end up, you still could end up cheating. Because this is a message from Briggs, traditional tricks like cross-validation all cheat and reuse what is already known as if it were unknown. They repackage the old as new. Okay, so the true and only test of model goodness is how well that model predicts data never before seen or used in any way. So we can't actually stop there, and this is usually where people do stop. So it's important to think about actually what you're doing, especially with this cross-validation approach. If you think about training, you know, in the machine learning world, you don't just train a single GLM. What you do is you'll train, like, you know, actually 50 maybe GBMs, because each time you tune a hyperparameter or tune a different aspect of that model, that's another model that you're training and testing, and you're picking the best one each time. So the more models you train in that way, the more that you end up actually overfitting to that particular configuration of cross-validation. So that's quite important, which is why we need to think about actually, well, okay, always have that validation set. But then think about that again, is that you're doing your cross-validation, you get your result, you test on your validation set. Depending on how much worse the performance is, that gives you an idea of how much your model is overfitting to the cross-validation data set. But ultimately, keep in mind that that validation set is just a single sample of the data. Okay, so that means that we're just getting a single point estimate for that, how well it's going to perform in the future. And it's not a single value, it's a distribution. Okay, if there could be any amount of data that appears in the future, it could be any... it could be, you know, basically, ideally what we would want is we'd want 100 different validation sets to get that distribution. Unfortunately, we don't have that. It's important to keep in mind that we don't have that, and so that point estimate can still lead to overconfidence. So that's a couple of ways that things can go wrong, but there's plenty more. And it's quite important to just think about these things, because knowing how it can go wrong in the first place can help us think about what adjustments need to be made and how to avoid it. So just a few that I don't know if you're aware of or have seen before, but things like the square peg bias. So, you know, the model's built on previous data, so it might not necessarily be useful for future data. Just in general, the issue with models becoming outdated. Wolf and sheep's clothing bias, so making sure that the metrics or data that you're actually using inside your model makes sense. A really good example of this was a model built in the US. I'm not sure you've heard of it. It's in Weapons of Mass Destruction by Kathy O'Neill. Basically, the idea is that they tried to predict how well a teacher would, how the performance of teachers. Okay, and the metric that they actually used for the performance of teachers, what they were trying to predict, made absolutely no sense whatsoever. So the models came out looking really, really good, but it was terribly predictive of whether or not teachers would actually perform very well because they had used the wrong metric that didn't actually reflect performance. Missing wood for the trees, just missing, like, the basically the model is missing a really big, important factor. And my favourite is the insatiable monster bias. So the idea that if you let your model run free, it can do all sorts of things like predict a premium of $120,000 for a renewal, for a neural car insurance quote. So keeping in mind that your models can do this and putting in various sufficient safeguards to make sure that that kind of thing doesn't happen. So that leads on quite nicely to my favourite thing to talk about, which is ethics and what is fair. So there's been quite a bit of discussion about this recently, and I think the conclusion generally is that this is a really hard problem and it's not something that we can take for granted. So first of all, what are ethics? Well, ethics are not regulations. Ethics are shared social values or rules. So even that's kind of the first point, is that it's really hard to define what fair is. And I've listed five definitions of fairness there that come from a paper that I'll mention in a bit, but just a couple of examples of what kinds of definitions of fairness you can have. So one is fairness through unawareness. So this is the idea that your algorithm or model is fair if it doesn't actually include the protected variable like race or gender. So if your model doesn't use race or gender, then under the fairness through unawareness definition, it is fair. Okay, then you might have something like individual fairness. Individual fairness is the idea that if two individuals are similar, then the prediction from the model should be similar. Okay, so this basically equates to making sure that your model is somewhat smooth. Demographic parity is more about saying, okay, well, you know, the prediction for the prediction for someone who is of a particular race would be the same for them if they were of a different race. Okay, so basically saying that the model's not necessarily dependent on that variable. So that's demographic parity. Equality of opportunity is somewhat similar, although it takes into account the fact that there might be different proportions of a particular race with different target variables. So, for example, if you're predicting whether or not someone's going to commit a crime or not, well, there's probably a high proportion of black people who have committed a crime in the first place. Well, not necessarily committed a crime, but being caught or put in jail for that crime. So that kind of equals out the idea that you have different proportions of, say, race or gender in each of the what you're trying to predict. And then counterfactual fairness goes a step beyond that, because one of the issues with equality of opportunity is that, you know, the target variable, so whether or not someone committed a crime or not, may not actually be true in the first place. Okay, so it's not just that someone didn't commit a crime, it's just that they weren't caught. It's not just that someone didn't commit fraud, it's just that they weren't caught. So counterfactual fairness is the idea that you can take someone in the current world and then, you know, have a prediction, so their premium in the current world. You can move them into a counterfactual world where basically the only things that are kept constant in the counterfactual world are those things that aren't caused by race or gender. And everything that's to do with race or gender changes according to, you know, if they were born in that particular world with a different race or a different gender. Okay, so this is actually quite hard to do in practice and requires, as you can imagine, a causal framework. But the one thing to really take away from this, there's five definitions of fairness for you, and they're not compatible. So you cannot actually satisfy all these definitions of fairness, so which one do you even choose? And so this kind of brings back to the point of thinking about a causal world versus the machine learning world where we're thinking about correlations. As one particular example is the fairness to run awareness. Okay, if that is true, then you can't have counterfactual fairness. So, regulations encourage us to behave ethically, i.e. not rating on race or gender. They say you're not allowed to have that in your model. But this does not mean necessarily that we're being ethical. The fairness around awareness is a fine definition of fairness to have in a world where we have, you know, models that are built with causation in mind. But as soon as we move to a world where we're simply looking at correlations, hidden correlations or hidden causes, hidden correlations with, say, race can still come through in your model. So if we start leaving out sensible variables, we can become unable to understand what the actual causes of certain observations are, which could be the sensitive variables themselves, and are therefore unable to prevent bias against those sensitive attributes. So a good example of this, which comes from a paper that was written a year ago on counterfactual fairness, is the red car scenario. So imagine you're a car insurance company pricing car insurance premiums for people. You look through your data and race is not available to rate on. Okay, but what you notice is that red cars tend to be associated with more aggressive drivers. So you go, great, I'm going to add a red car into my model, and then ACE have premiums based on whether or not someone drives a red car or not. But say there's a particular race or a particular gender or some protected variable. So say there's a particular race, say, I don't know, elves or dwarves or something. We'll go with elves. And they really, really like driving red cars because they stand out in the forests and they can see them well. Okay? But they may not necessarily be aggressive drivers because they don't, you know, they're lovely people, they're the tree folk, they're not aggressive at all. But by rating on red car, because, you know, it increases premiums, you're unfairly picking out the elves because they happen to like driving red cars. So it's this idea that by not including race, you're actually making it unfair, whereas if you had included race in that model, it would have picked out the fact that, okay, red cars is only associated with aggressive driving if you're not an elf, because you're able to put elf in the model. So just thinking about what our assumptions are about what is fair, and thinking beyond, oh, the regulations tell me I'm not allowed to include race or gender, that's fine maybe if we're thinking about what causes the premiums, or causes claims and risk. Not so good if we're thinking about building models that are a little bit more difficult to interpret. So we've kind of gone through a whirlwind of picking out lots of different things that, you know, we can probably spend a bit more time thinking about. What can go wrong? Selection bias, data prep. We didn't talk about all of these, but these are just some additional thoughts to provoke discussion. Whether or not smoothing and or distortion actually helps you at all, or whether it basically is an additional form of bias that you're putting into your models. How overfitting can occur and how you can have overconfidence in your models. How models can be wrong when you're actually applying it, different circumstances where it can go wrong. Is it actually unethical despite the regulatory checkboxes that you've put in? Is it misunderstood and so misapplied? And something we didn't talk about is actually this feedback loop, which is an interesting one where actually the model's predictions can cause changes in behaviour. Importantly, changes in the very variables that you're using in your model in the first place. So being careful of feedback loops that might occur, model becoming outdated. And the big conclusion, I guess, to all this is really ignorance is not bliss. Okay, we can't just go from how we did our models before, especially now as we move to, you know, big data, advanced analytics, where some of these things can become a lot more of an issue. A lot of these, you know, used to be issues before, but can tend to be quite more of an issue now the more that we don't understand our models. With great power comes great responsibility. So we need to make sure that we're actually thinking of these and not just blindly putting our models, you know, into industry and actually pricing people or you know, basically making financial decisions for individuals based on things that we don't necessarily truly understand, especially if there are all these ways where the model can go wrong that we've just ignored, as opposed to finding out ways that we can measure them. Kind of leads into discussions around actually how do we quantify model risk and, you know, to what extent they impact model risk and how can we see, you know, the different aspects of you know, what can go wrong and how we can mitigate a lot of that risk. So now we're probably going to open it up to questions, comments, and challenges. I don't know, Matthew, if you wanted to say anything else before we open up to the floor.
No, could I just remind you, if you're going to ask a question, could you please raise your hand and a mic will be brought to you, and just let us know what your name is and whether you're a student or fellow member of the IFOA. Unless you don't want to win a bottle of champagne, then it doesn't matter.
Hi, my name is Fawaz, and I'm a fellow. And basically, my question was about sensitive variables. I guess sensitive variables such as race, for example, or other ones like that, are often proxies for other things, like socioeconomic circumstances, or treatment of minorities, or whatever, depending on the country that you're in. So it's one thing to sort of, obviously they have, it can have sensitive variables like that, can have a predictive power at a given point in time because they're because they are proxies, powerful proxies even for other things. But that will change over time. So how do the models cope with the fact that, say, if there's better education policies or better social policies and this and that over time, that things like race, for example, become less of a predictor than before? How do you analyze and refine for that over time? And I guess the point of the laws that sort of ban you from using sensitive variables or restrict the use of them is to try to force you to sort of examine the causal nature of underlying things more closely. So I don't think you can get away from causality, no matter how much data you sort of have.
Yes, I agree with that. I don't think I would challenge that we cannot build a model where we don't understand the causality going into that and claim that it's fair. So I definitely am on board with that, but I think it's generally an open discussion for what people think. The key thing is, so your point about, changing over time, I think that calls out to the fact that, fairness isn't necessarily about just having a single rule that we apply going forward. And if we truly want fair and ethical models, we need to be constantly reevaluating exactly what that means and making decisions about what that means. I think that's a better world to be in, where we're consciously making those decisions as opposed to just checking some boxes, which we can do or leave to an algorithm to do. Actually thinking about, race and gender feels like, for me, the reason we don't include them is because you can't help race or gender. So that shouldn't be a cause of your premium, even if it is actually a cause, it shouldn't. It shouldn't be, because theoretically it shouldn't be, right?
Well, even if it is highly associated with other underlying causes, more precisely than possibly.
Yeah.
As I said, which are driven again by circumstances maybe beyond individuals' controls or whatever. But how do you regulate the model in that way?
I don't think there's an answer for that, and I think that's why there's so much research going into this, is that it's really difficult to make an algorithm fair, especially machine learning algorithms, because, I don't think those answers are known. I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
It's a very good, absolutely, it's in my briefcase, but no, it's a very good question. I mean, there's two interesting angles here. One is if it's something that's just known, which is, gender is normally known, you have to drink, then you can clearly allow for that in your model, but then there may be concern that you shouldn't be allowing for that explicitly in your model, but clearly, as we've seen, you need to allow for it explicitly in a model in order to ensure that it's not being allowed for in the end result. So if you know something, that's actually something you can do with it, even if it may seem slightly sort of the converse of what you might expect. But it's clearly much more difficult if it's something you don't know. So race in particular in the UK, whereas I think in the States are much more open about recording race, and it seems to be much more of a sensitive problem. I sort of pretty like the other point about just trying to be more explicit about what we're assuming. Clearly, it's one of these things where every assumption is going to be wrong, but at least if you're explicit about what you're assuming, then it helps people to sort of understand what's going on.
Thanks, guys.
I'm Emily Dimitriadis, a fellow. So are you saying that typically in the industry we're not including these things in the model because we're saying they're you know, they're excluded for, say, regulatory purposes? Because it sounds like people are excluding them. I thought we weren't allowed to use them for the end result, but it seems almost like an error to not include them then in that respect.
Yeah, it depends on the application. Different firms go about these things in different ways. So, obviously, there's some nice examples on this one. It's gender for insurance pricing, where the sort of standard approach is you sort of include gender in your models, you'd end up with male rates and female rates, and then you take a weighted average according to your assumption about the mix, and then go with that. In normal life pricing, there are probably also more subtle ways of doing things, and there's also a problem of needing to make sure that things like postcode aren't coming through unknowingly as a gender proxy, which would happen if you do the modelling without gender. Or would probably happen if you do the modelling without gender.
Hi, Gary Yates Fellow. You mentioned monster error or monster bias, where the results are quite far away from the target, I guess. Do you have any thoughts on whether that's larger for linear models versus non-linear models? And then you said you have some tips for how to reduce, some thoughts how to reduce that monster error in practice.
So just to try to answer correctly, do you sort of say, you were asking basically whether it's possible to allow for bias in linear as opposed to non-linear models, is that what you said?
Yeah. Sorry, I actually missed that question. It was a little bit quiet to hear. Can you speak up a little bit?
So you mentioned monster error or monster bias, I can't remember what you called it.
Yes.
Is it larger in GLMs or non-linear models?
I don't think there's any one particular class of model which is necessarily more or less prone to bias than others. I mean, a lot of the bias examples we had were obviously to do with data, that sort of algorithmic bias slide we had with the five different sources there. There could be all of those biases, types of bias could apply to any type of model. So I wouldn't have said there's necessarily an association between any one type of model and any one type of bias.
I don't necessarily know the actual answer to this. I mean, part of why we present all of this is that we can encourage more thought and actual investigation into this. But I would say that in, say, GLM models, it might be easier for an external reviewer to pick it up or for you to see what's going on versus, say, a more non-linear, black boxy type model where there's a lot more going into it and therefore a lot more that can go wrong, potentially undetected.
And the second half is some practical tips on how to reduce that sort of error.
Think about it. I think that there's so many different types. And if I think about how I go about building models and the number of things that actually go into it are quite extensive, the number of things you think about, the number of things you check, the number of things you ask other people to check, and then you get someone independent to come and have a look at it and make sure you haven't done anything silly or stupid or forgotten something, etc. My biggest tip would be actually just be really, really critical of anything that comes. Make sure you understand everything that's coming out. The more you understand exactly what's going on, the more you can actually validate it. It's just so, it depends, right? There's so many things that can go wrong as long as you're aware of what's going wrong.
It's more of an argument in terms of simplicity, all other things being equal, simplicity as opposed to complexity. And one of the things we use in sort of the work presentations with clients is a set of six criteria for helping to choose what approach to take, and one of those is a suspect of being able to understand and interpret the results. And clearly, all other things being equal, the simpler the approach, you know, given it's meeting a certain predictive criteria, then the better, because it helps to sort of reduce that risk.
This is a more technical question. I'm a professor at Cass Business School, and I'm I worked quite a bit in I noticed that you mentioned cross-validation was a new thing. And I think I filed my PhD thesis on cross-validation around the time when you were born, Maurice.
I didn't mean it as a new thing.
And I was following one of the most famous statisticians in the recent time from Australia, Peter Hall.
Peter who, sorry?
Peter Hall.
Okay.
He's not Peter who. I mean, he was number six in the world if he had been a university on his own in his days. However, what he came up with in the 80s was that working just in one dimension is cross-validation is by far the most noisy model selection criteria you could think of. And a lot of the research since then has been on how to get to other ways of selection than cross-validation because it's so noisy. And I get worried when I hear about machine learning and cross-validation because now it's not in one dimension and it really doesn't work very well in one dimension. And now we are in 100 dimensions.
Yeah.
And we're not only in 100 dimensions, we are in 100 models in 100 selection, in 100 dimensions and 100 models. So what is the chance? I mean, to me, there is a big chance that we end up with a wrong result, false discoveries, doing all these things because of all the noise in cross-validation. Do you have a comment? Do you have tried anything like that? I have a comment.
So a couple of comments, and again, I don't know the answer to these, but potentially, I don't know, you might have the answer to this, is, so firstly, is it, while it might be a wrong answer, is it still worse than just doing one lot of validation on a single validation set versus doing it across multiple? I don't actually know the answer to that. I don't know of any empirical studies that maybe there have been some that look at that. The other thing I would say is actually it raises a very good point. So I come from, when I did was at university, I learnt both the actuarial foundation, the actuarial way of teaching things, at least the Australian actuarial way of teaching things. I'm not sure if that's the same or different. And the computer science machine learning way of approaching things. And in machine learning, the be-all and end-all is cross-validation. And if you look at any data scientist out there, that's just standard. And I think it raises an interesting point that data science is a very unregulated industry, whereas actuarial profession is very regulated. So we need to be, it's probably something to think of that, yeah, okay, just because all of these things are quite popular, keep in mind it's very unregulated. The data scientists that just came out of university, yes, they may know exactly what they're talking about, but that a lot of the methods that they use because everyone uses them, and there seems to be a lot less of the rigor, although there definitely is in lots of scientific papers, like no doubt your PhD. Learning about data science and you do those courses, they don't talk about any of that. It's cross-validation is it.
So just adding to that, my concern with cross-validation is giving too much of an air of certainty, and it's brought out in the quotation from Briggs that which I sort of didn't think of it, have a better way to articulate it, but it always strikes me that if you're working with any one data set, then whatever you're doing within that data set, you're always very much subject to the deficiencies of that data set, in particular bias, and the only way to arrive at the aim which you correctly want to arrive at is to sort of have a completely independent data set with a completely independent and set of different errors and biases. Otherwise, it's what you're always going to be sort of subject to the limitations of your first data set, however large it is.
I think there's a big danger of overconfidence in reporting our results, and we need to pay a bit more attention to understanding, even if we come to the conclusion that actually it doesn't matter, it's fine. Instead of just assuming that it doesn't matter, we should probably do a bit of thinking around, does it matter? There's a question over there, I think.
I'm closer. So my name is Dylan, I'm a student. I'm just wondering, do you think that the inherently long-term nature of life insurance, coupled with all the ethical and regulatory limitations on rating factors that you mentioned, render some of the benefits of machine learning fairly muted?
I don't want to throw it out as being something that we should never look at, but I definitely agree with your sentiment there that we need to, just because it's a fancy new technique, we need to think about actually what problems does it solve. types of problems it solves is, like basically finding causes that maybe we didn't know existed before. So maybe it's useful if suddenly we have a lot of extra data about individuals. It can help us build models quickly. Maybe that's useful, but, we need to actually think about, will it be useful? What are the barriers like? The fact that, it can be potentially very unethical or have unethical results. And the fact that, it's purely based on historical data and it actually can be quite difficult to embed expert judgment into these algorithms. Maybe life insurance is definitely a more difficult problem to solve in terms of finding applications for it. That being said, I don't necessarily think there are none. If anyone has any, then we're certainly trialing it, but again, being very careful that of those very issues.
Yeah, I'll make the distinction. It's a good question. I'll make the distinction between two aspects of the applications of all these techniques in life insurance. One is to sort of behaviour, and the other is to the underlying risk. So for behaviour, especially for sort of point of sale, purchase of behaviour, even though your model now might be wrong in 10 years' time, it doesn't really matter if it's helping you to make the sale or whatever. But clearly, the underlying risk is questions whether we're getting much benefit on that. And I think to apologetically use the, sort of the cliche of low-lying fruit. I was going to say low-flying fruit, but it's probably low-lying. A lot of that in terms of postcode and socioeconomic class and occupation and benefit amount and all that stuff has been well studied for many years, just with sort of GLMs and so on, before sort of more razzmatazz methods. So I don't think as much as effectively you're either saying or implying there's much less benefit to be gained there.
Yeah, the areas, so we've done a lot of research in this, and the areas that we've found to be most beneficial are the ones where the underlying relationships in the data are quite complex, or there's enough data that you can have quite complex relationships. Ones where, what was the other one? It's a complete mind blank there.
Which mind blank?
And where you need to build lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of models in a very short period of time. So, for example, in the States, if they're building pricing models, you might need to build one for every state and maybe one for every type of claim that they see, accidental damage or third-party property damage. So they're building 32 models. So for them, the benefits of machine learning are, well, let's do this really, really quickly then. Even if you do end up with a GLM at the end, you can still use some machine learning methods to say, well, quickly just build me something that, looks like a GLM that we can easily put a GLM on top of or something along those lines. So that tends to be where we find the real benefits.
Stephen Baxter, fellow, thank you for a wonderful presentation. I'm going to ask a slightly provocative question, if I may, and for that reason, I'm not going to just ask the panel, but perhaps everyone in the room. Given you've highlighted a number of pitfalls with some of the modern machine learning techniques, and given the humongous big data warehouses that exist in the likes of Google and Facebook and such like, and their stated ambitions that they might enter the insurance market in the future, how concerned should we be for our industry, for consumers, and for us as a profession with the risk of unregulated data science encroaching on areas which have been traditionally our roles? And what, if anything, should we do to react to that situation?
Well, it's a good question. I think it's one that's been knocking around for quite a few years. Every year I always think, this must be the year that Google gets into the insurance market. I'm always surprised when they don't. And like some of the other big names, and clearly if they start an insurer tomorrow with all the data they've got, both in terms of analysing more the behaviour, maybe to less extent the underlying risk, but certainly have enough data to have very, very predictive models on both of those, that ended up becoming primarily a question of the extent to which the sort of regulatory framework could actually prevent them from, well, I guess as you were implying, sort of abusing their sort of data power, to sort of coin a new phrase. So it's not that sort of yes or no answer, it's just sort of share your concern and end up being more of a sort of a regulatory concern. As some of the banks, the sort of big banking groups, sort of the bank and the insurer, and, as you've probably spoken to some of the people yourselves, you've got sort of five million, 6 million accounts worth of information which the insurer can access to study a huge amount of stuff, and they've been, obviously, you could be tempted to use that for sort of very predictive models, but I think on the whole they've sort of felt obliged not to go the whole way, or maybe they've not.
Yeah, I think there's a big risk too with the fact that the regulatory body, especially with things moving so quickly, it can be difficult to keep up with what regulations are required until something goes horribly wrong, which is definitely a big risk with something like that. We might not necessarily know the impacts of that kind of thing until it happens, and then only then will the regulatory bodies come in with regulations to stop that. In terms of what we can do, I think it's just, basically we need to almost do what we do best, which is understand exactly what's going on and understand risk and, to what extent we can do research around these things. If we think it's an issue and we think it's potentially going to harm consumers, etc., then if we can provide some sort of evidence or at least convince more and more people, convince the regulatory bodies that more needs to be done, then we should aim to do that as much as we can. And then, maybe even keep in mind that, society might change. What is fair may change. Our definition of that may change. I don't know, I heard a while ago the credit rating thing came in, and initially it was a big hoo-ha that you can't possibly have a credit score because that's not really fair, but then eventually everyone kind of got used to it, so I wouldn't completely throw it out the window that maybe we'll reach a world where, again, I'm not sure how likely it is, but maybe we will reach a world where privacy and, what we normally consider to be ethical now suddenly doesn't apply. I don't know.
Paul Brett, I'm a fellow. Firstly, I get worried when I see all this or hear all this, because in my day, modelling was a lot easier. I had some difficulties when you talked about ethics or not. I mean, I thought, is it more what's legal and what's not legal rather than ethical? Because sort of race, I can see that's probably more ethical. Male, female, that's just because the law says you're not allowed to do it. Don't know whether I'd say that was necessarily ethical, because then I'd say, well, age shouldn't, should you be able to rate on age? And
yeah, so I think ethics leads what becomes legal or not. You raise an interesting point about, well, if it's not necessary, if it's legal to do, then is that what you were saying, that if it's legal, if it's like race is not legal, is legal, sorry, so it's fine.
So if it's legal, you can do it.
Yeah. So I think that's an interesting point, because in some senses, yes, but also, moral part of me is hating me for saying that. But you also need to think about the potential backlash and risk of people not being happy with what's happening. Just because it's legal now doesn't mean that something bad will happen. Something bad won't happen in the future, and then it will become illegal in the future when they realise how bad it can be. And I guess almost brand risk or risk to the company or whatever it might be, the fact that, maybe you could cause, however many individuals of a particular race to suffer financially, whether that's okay to do is another question. In terms of the bottom line, it's the brand risk of if that gets out later on and they realise that you've just been horrible people, then that's not so good for your image.
There's also that's a context of market practice, and well, the whole idea of what the context is. An interesting example of that would be this whole idea within motor pricing of you've got a sort of combination of allowing new models, not just for the underlying risk, but also the pricing behaviour of policyholders at point of sale, and then also the lapse retention characteristics. And so it became common practice to effectively if a policyholder seems to be fairly loyal, in other words, there's a fairly small chance they lapse if you keep on bumping up the premiums, then you're effectively penalising the loyal policyholders. So the opposite of a loyalty bonus, and that became fairly common practice, and that was debated sort of here getting on for 8 or 9 years ago, and then the philosophy, which I think was accepted within the actuarial profession and by the regulator at the time, was it because it's a very competitive market. You had lots of firms offering lots of different prices. It was a very competitive market. If some firms are setting their prices in a way which, you know, from that description sounds quite unethical, then because it's a free market, it doesn't matter. And it's a free market where you've got a sort of a one-year contract as opposed to somebody's life savings. It's very dependent, I think, on the contract. I mean, it's all on the context.
Are there any more questions, particularly from student members?
Hi, my name is Jeremy. I'm a student. So I've got a question about looking towards the future. Like, if you think about it, insurance and actuarial, it's traditionally been quite slow to react to change. So nowadays, when you read about machine learning algorithms, you know, you think about data scientists, whether they can do it so much better than we can. Is there any reason why we should still learn it? So should we focus on the ethical issues, the expert judgment issues instead? So I guess my question is, what is the next big thing that we should perhaps learn about instead of as a student, learn about all these algorithms that could be done so much better by the data scientists themselves?
Predicting the future.
I suppose that actually lends itself to the point I was going to make, which is, if we were hoping to take all this, is to, in terms of hopefully another area of interesting expansion or whatever development, tying in with this theme, and your question is trying to sort of do more research into those types of models which combine sort of the best of both worlds, which combine this sort of advanced analytics, machine learning techniques with some degree of causal inference. And there are several types of such model around. I'm sort of looking really to try and form some sort of mini working party to try and take that forward, so we end up with a sort of best of both context.
I'd also say that, I mean, machine learning and AI has all been developed pretty much for very specific use cases which aren't necessarily that well aligned to the insurance industry's use case. So especially as someone who's come in, you know, from the computer science side of things, it's probably one of the most difficult applications in terms of being able to take what you know as a data scientist and being able to actually apply that in an insurance case, because there are so many weird things to think about that just don't apply when you're predicting whether or not a picture is a cat or not. So I think while there's been a lot of advances in AI and machine learning, most of those have not been with insurance necessarily in mind. So I still think there's probably a lot we can do, because, you know, we're still in a way we're shoehorning the insurance problem into a machine learning algorithm, not necessarily actually thinking from a ground up actually what are the problems we're trying to solve and what is the best way to do this. I think we can learn a lot from AI and machine learning, but I don't think it's actually mapped quite directly across just yet. I think there's still a lot of development to happen there. So I definitely wouldn't rule it out as something that data scientists can do so much better, because, yeah, a lot of them have no idea about the insurance industry.
Thanks. Just to add to that answer, really, you seem to be assuming that they are mutually exclusive. I would say it'd be much easier to get an actuary to learn to be a data scientist than to pick a data scientist and train them up to be an actuary. So there's no reason why you can't be both.
Yeah, and I think that's actually needed. Definitely more of that kind of thing happening, although I'm sure there's plenty of that kind of thing happening as anyway.
Okay, if we've no more questions, just like to say, it was a really interesting topic tonight and it was delivered really well, so thank you, Matthew and Rachel, for that. And also thank you to everyone in the audience, especially those of you who participated tonight and helped to expand the discussion. I'm going to award the champagne to Stephen Baxter in the second row for your... Sorry, I didn't realise, but yeah, you won't win again. I'm only joking. And also to the student in the second row, I'm really sorry I didn't get your name, but it was a question on the usefulness of machine learning and big data. So if you guys could come up at the end to collect your champagne, that would be great. And just to remind everyone, we'll send around an email with a survey for feedback tomorrow. So if you could please fill that in, that would be great. We'll also have drinks and sandwiches afterwards, so please join us if you can. And could we just thank... Matthew, I think, just wants to say...
Sorry, thanks. So just to reiterate the thing I was saying at my last answer, we are looking to potentially form two sort of working groups or parties or whatever, one to sort of investigate this whole idea of sort of the best of both, sort of causal machine learning, and potentially another one to look at everything from a sort of a CRO risk officer perspective. Again, think of all the things that can go wrong in all the different parts of the chain, how we might be able to sort of put together some sort of guide for CROs. So if you're interested in getting involved in either of those, please get in touch with either of us, and then if I try and link in with the Michael Tripps MAID party and see how it would all fit as part of that. Sorry, thanks.
No, thank you. And can we just thank the speakers in the usual way?